ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What do you get if you give a bunch of economists a scheme to design and then don't pay attention? You get, we've got, a National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, that was expected to cost $14 billion per year and now costs $54 billion, that takes in a quarter of a million more people than expected, most of them children, and now services 15% of all six-year-old boys, most of them for autism. The NDIS now costs more than Medicare, more than the Commonwealth spends on aged care, and more than it spends on hospitals. And it's growing twice as fast. The government has pushed through Parliament changes to cut that back. But how did it come to this? What is it about a scheme designed by economists, one built around the untested idea of a market for disability support, that saw it so comprehensively trounced by reality? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and two people who've thought a lot about how the NDIS has turned out. One of them worked on it. Sam Bennett led the research division of the National Disability Insurance Agency and is now in charge of disability at the Grattan Institute. The other is Pelin Akyol, who's tracked the NDIS as research manager of the E61 Institute, where she also specialises in labour markets, education and health. Welcome, Pelin, and welcome, Sam.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Sam, I think most people would agree that the idea of the NDIS is a good one. I was at the press conference 15 years ago where the Productivity Commission unveiled the idea. There was a lot of excitement in the room. People were saying it felt like the birth of Medicare. All these years on, with the benefit of hindsight, was there anything wrong, fundamentally wrong, with the design of the scheme?
There was, Peter. I mean, I think many of the problems we now see writ large as a result of design and governance failures that were baked into the NDIS from the very beginning. This kind of system, it relies on consumers acting like they would in a competitive market. But in reality, we're talking about some of Australia's most vulnerable people that are also not very well informed. There is huge information asymmetry in this marketplace.
Information asymmetry means that the seller, in this case, I suppose the supplier of disability services or the plan manager, knows stuff that the buyer doesn't. The kind of thing that can make, in fact, it probably makes a lot of markets not work, probably makes the market for electricity and cars and so on not work.
I think that's right. But in the NDIS market, you've had a government that's taken a particularly hands-off approach to stewarding this marketplace. Stewardship of aged care and other sort of marketplaces is much more hands-on. In traditional service delivery, government directly contracts for providers. And Australia is quite an anomaly, really, in relying totally on the marketplace. If you compare the NDIS to the design of other contemporary disability systems in other jurisdictions internationally, they've tended to combine the option of individualised funding, which is...
We would be the only one that wasn't a mixed system that was all you get your notional budget and you spend it in a market?
We would be the only one where government has relinquished all commissioning control and where you have a one-size-fits-all approach, when clearly one size does not fit all. And when you combine that with complex and vague legislative criteria that govern the way that eligibility works and how funding is allocated, it's led to predictable escalations in scope and cost over time.
Pelin, we're extraordinarily bad, even at standard markets, at picking the best electricity provider and so on and having them compete on the basis of cost. You've looked at what was actually charged, going through tens of thousands of invoices and compared them to the price caps, the maximum price that the government allows. What did you find when you looked at those NDIS invoices?
What we see is that providers tend to charge at or very close to the price cap.
Hardly any price competition.
No, it seems like there is no price competition. And what happens is when there's an increase in price caps, market prices go up. When the cap comes down, market prices come down.
Sam, there was arguably another flaw in the design, not necessarily the Productivity Commission's fault, this one came in later, which is that the service provider providing caring services or the professionals associated with the provider got to determine who was eligible for the NDIS. Is that how it worked?
In the earlier days, driven by some overly ambitious bilateral agreements which dictated the whole pace of the rollout, the focus was all on getting people onto the scheme, and that led to the adoption of these access lists, which operated very much as a shortcut onto the scheme for particular diagnoses, most notably autism assessed at a level two. And there's some pretty compelling evidence out there now that this shortcut to services has really impacted on diagnostic behaviour. You rarely hear of a level one diagnosis anywhere anymore, for example. And to your point, Peter, there are some potentially perverse incentives in this system too, given that treating health professionals that can provide a diagnosis can be the same health professionals that then go on to provide therapies for people that are found eligible. So there are some pretty perverse incentives built into the way that it operates.
Is part of the problem, Sam, that it was never completely clear who was in the scheme and who was out of it? I remember at that first press conference, indeed, there was no talk of autism. I've searched the executive summary of the Productivity Commission report. There was talk of physical disabilities. That's what we thought we were dealing with then. Has the scheme sort of grown? Have other things got sucked into it?
Yeah, including very late inclusions that you'll recall, Peter, I'm sure. So the Productivity Commission didn't model the number of people with a psychosocial disability that might come onto the NDIS, but in the end, it was included within the scope. So there was always a real risk. The NDIS was not supposed to replace the role of other service systems, whether that's the health or the mental health system. And yet we have this new program that came into being that's demand-driven, intentionally uncapped, and essentially open-ended in what it can provide as well, I should add, rubbing up against these other systems that are absolutely not governed by those principles and face real challenges, in fact, as a result of budgetary constraints. So you create this guilt-edged opportunity for cost shifting, particularly when state contributions to the NDIS were capped, with the federal government holding all of the upside growth risk. So you had this situation where the states, to a greater or lesser extent, because it was different from one to another, rolled all of their disability funding into the NDIS and withdrew lots of their services as well in a way that wasn't fully expected. I mean, it was never intended that the NDIS would be the only source of disability support in Australia. That original PC design was predicated on a tiered approach where lower levels of support were available and states continued to play an ongoing, if lesser, role. But that feature of the design, it just never eventuated. So you have this irresistible demand pull into the NDIS as the only game in town, and as well as these misaligned incentives that Pelham was talking about across the system that have combined to push the scope of the NDIS ever outwards.
You're giving me an impression of the Productivity Commission, of all organisations, not understanding incentives. The incentive for the state government to withdraw, the incentive to have people diagnosed. Pelham, behind the reasoning at the beginning, behind the Productivity Commission's report, was this big piece of reassurance that the NDIS would to some extent pay for itself by getting disabled Australians into the workforce and freeing up their carers to enter the workforce. Initially, we were told that over time there'd be 200,000 more paid Australian workers. You've examined what's actually happened to carers, to individual carers in the NDIS, whether they've been freed up to enter the paid workforce or not. What have you found at E61?
Actually, what is happening is the opposite. Rather than caring responsibilities falling, we observed an increase in caring responsibilities. Let me explain why it might be happening. So for partners, the increase is 7 hours per week. It is substantial. it might be a time period where participants' health is already deteriorated enough so that they are getting into NDIS. But on the top of that, NDIS is not an easy program to navigate. Families has to gather medical reports. They have to work with NDIA to set up the budget. And then they have to find providers, schedule the appointment, and learn, you know, how to navigate the system.
The bureaucracy of the NDIS, at least in the initial stages, and we're only in the initial stage, has resulted in more work by carers. It seems to have added more work than it's removed.
It seems like this is what's happening, actually.
No, I think Pelin's right. I think this is a very complicated scheme, and it's grown more and more complicated as the government and the agency over a period of the last 10 years has tried to fix things. But that just makes it harder and harder for people to navigate. And it has got to a point really where it's groaning under its own bureaucratic weight.
Complexity is something that users of the NDIS have to deal with, and it's something we're keen to examine here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guests, former National Disability Insurance Agency official Sam Bennett, now with the Grattan Institute, and NDIS researcher Pelin Akyol at E61. Sam, the package of changes introduced into Parliament this week aims to slow growth in spending on the NDIS from its present 11% a year to 5-6%, which would be in line with other programs. Do we need it to do that? Might the $50 billion plus and growing bill we've got simply be the price we need to pay to care for people with disabilities?
I think it's hard to make that argument, Peter, when the growth is so obviously uncontained over such a long period of time. I mean, it's really important, I think, that the growth rate is contained such that this great, potentially fantastic scheme, potentially still world-leading, can be there and endure for future generations of disabled Australians. It won't simply do that if it's forced to suck up ever more of the federal budget. It is the single biggest pressure on that budget. So I think it's a reasonable thing to aim for, 5-6%, in my view.
Two of the measures in the package unwind the peculiarities we've been talking about. One unwinds the idea of a market. The NDIS will be able to directly commission services itself rather than giving notional dollars to a disabled person or their carer to do it. The other change will require independent assessments. That is to say, someone not connected with a provider will have to work out whether people qualify for the NDIS. Do they both make sense?
They do, because they do attempt to fix long-standing structural issues with the NDIS design that we've been talking about. The functional assessment process, to start with that, is actually a government bureaucrat that will undertake that. And the intention there is to introduce a measure that is much more objective eligibility that better reflects the original design intent of the NDIS.
Yeah, a lot of people seem worried by that. There's talk of a new kind of robo-debt, of independent assessments by bureaucrats. Much as they might seem reasonable to someone not with a disability, they seem somewhat frightening if you're someone already on the scheme. And there's more than 250,000 people are scheduled to leave the scheme under these reforms.
Completely acknowledge that, Peter. I mean, I think it's worth just reflecting on the problem that this is attempting to fix, because it's not as if at the moment we have an equitable process that produces consistent or predictable results. We have a process where people have to combine a lot of their own evidence. They have to pay for that because the NDIS doesn't do that at the moment. What is then used is of really varying quality. Some pretty vague criteria are then applied to that to determine whether you get in or you don't. And that can depend on which individual bureaucrat, frankly, is making that decision on any given day. So there are inbuilt inequities in this that I think this is attempting to fix. There are legitimate concerns, though, as you allude to, because when you introduce this more objective threshold above which you would make entry to the scheme, below which you wouldn't, the government's own modelling suggests that upwards of 240,000 people that are currently on the scheme wouldn't be, and a further 110,000 people that would have come on to the scheme over the next 4 years under the existing policy settings won't. The challenge there is that these folks don't not have needs. It's reasonable, I think, to assume that we could meet those needs more effectively and efficiently than through the NDIS. But those other services, as we've been talking about, they don't currently exist. So it sets a clock ticking, frankly, because those eligibility changes come in from January 2028. That's less than 18 months away. Yet we need to build up these foundational supports, as they're called, in the language of the NDIS review from the other year. And at the moment, we don't have many of those in place. So people do risk falling through the cracks.
One of those schemes is called Thriving Kids. I think the idea is that if you have a disability that is so common that, in this case, one in seven six-year-old boys have it, it's no longer an individual disability. It's the kind of thing which should be dealt with in schools and broader forums.
It's a high prevalence outcome that deserves a more universal response. I think you're right. Thriving Kids is a good start. It's limited, though, to 0 to 8s. And I don't think that makes any sense. In Grattan's work, we've said it should be all school age. But I think the design of Thriving Kids is encouraging. This market-based model hasn't worked. And what most parents actually want, if their child has missed a couple of developmental milestones, is access to timely expert advice and support that's available in the places where their children already live, learn and play. And Thriving Kids could deliver that. But I'm skeptical as things stand as to whether the budget that's been committed to it is likely to be sufficient to meet the demand. And then there are other groups too that will need non-NDIS supports. And governments are leaving themselves precious little time to stand those up. We've got money committed in the federal budget, but it remains in the contingency reserve at the moment because we don't know what those services are going to be. And in particular, Grattan's drawn attention through our research to the significant unmet need that exists for people with a psychosocial disability that don't or won't qualify for the NDIS. And that should be the next cab off the rank, in my view.
Pelham, one of the things that the government is doing is allowing the NDIS to directly commission some services for support homes and so on, instead of relying on the consumer. Would another way to do it be to make the market actually work? And one way to do that would be giving recipients a stake by making them pay some of their own money through co-payments. Is that, I suppose, another approach to make it more market than quasi?
Definitely. I think co-payment is one option worth discussing. This market does not work like a normal competitive market. Participants have relatively little incentive to shop around and find better prices because when they get a service at a higher price,
the government pays it.
Yes. I mean, it is paid through NDIS. So a co-payment, small co-payment, may make participants more sensitive to prices so that they may look for value for money. However, the trade-offs here is equity. We don't want these participants to stop getting supports they need because of co-payments. It will not be easy, but it is important to bring back the demand-side pressure in this market.
You've found, though, that means testing the NDIS, which is a popular idea, as well as the idea of combating fraud, and fraud on the government's own figures turns out to be very, very low, that means testing the NDIS would achieve little. That is to say that this idea of millionaires getting the NDIS is an urban myth. What did you do to find that out?
We looked at admin data and looked at participants' capacity to pay for the supports they need. And what we find is quite striking. About 73% of total NDIS spending goes to participants in families with adjusted income below $40,000 per year.
Below $40,000.
So we are talking about participants with very little capacity to pay for the supports. And even more striking finding is 87% of adult participants are already in disability support pension, which is income and asset tested. So our finding shows that means testing the NDIS will save around $4.5 billion, and $3.5 billion of this will come from children aged 0 to 17.
Who are basically going to be moved off, a lot of them, the NDIS in the reforms the government has planned.
Exactly, exactly.
Sam, your biggest criticism when you appeared before the Senate on the last day of its hearings this month, was about one of the crudest measures in the government's package. It's the ability of the minister to arbitrarily slash spending by up to 99%, so that's do everything other than kill it, across the board on any type of support. The minister's already announced a cut of 50% in one type of support and a cut of 10% in another. That is to say, you'll get what you're assessed, except you'll get 50% less or 10% less. What's so wrong with that power in the minister's hands to direct across the board cuts, in your view?
Well, I would distinguish, Peter, between measures in the bill and the reform package that it enables that actually serve to fix real issues and problems with the scheme design, and we've talked about quite a lot of those. And this measure, which is just blunt and frankly quite poorly thought through as well, not least in terms of how it would practically be implemented, it just isn't a good policy. So we've got real concerns about the 50% cut of social and community participation budgets for participants across the board. Social connection, it's a recognised determinant of health and well-being, and people with disability already face highly elevated risks of isolation and loneliness. So reducing those supports, it risks deepening an area where people with disability already face very significant disadvantages. And the NDIS was specifically designed to try and remedy that issue. The NDIS was not supposed to be a basic subsistence scheme that just made sure disabled Australians could get out of bed in the morning, be toileted and fed. It had rather more ambitious aspirations, as you'll recall, Peter, around social and economic participation. And we can debate whether those have been achieved. But this kind of cut is really quite anathema to that. And it's also not needed if the government's to get the scheme down to 5 to 6% in our analysis.
It's not?
No, it's not. 5 to 6% is the goal over the medium term, we've been told. We think that's perfectly reasonable. What the current package of cuts does is it brings that growth rate down to only 1.1% over the next 4 years. If you were to take out the social and community participation cuts altogether, it would still be down to 3%, which is a massive reduction from where we are this year. So I don't think the case has really been made as to why a cut that's this deep and quick is needed to get to that 5 to 6% reasonable growth target.
Are you objecting to two things here? One is that on an unclear basis, it's been decided that social community support, getting out, is less important than having a certain number of showers per week. One should be cut and not the other. And is your other concern that the minister alone has the power to arbitrarily say, well, I want all of this particular sort of support cut by so much?
It's not my phrase, so I won't coin it as such, but certainly some of the things that came out of the Senate hearings were describing this as a sort of Henry VIII type power. It really is quite, you know, unique to my understanding of this level of power residing in the minister or any future minister for that matter to reduce supports of any category, you know, quite significantly by 99.9%. So, I mean, I think it is a very strange thing to legislate, which comes with all sorts of risks. And I would dispute that hierarchy of need that is in the government's thinking that somehow these supports are of lesser value or less important. In reality, a lot of this funding is used flexibly. So it's actually very hard to unpick the kinds of supports that government says it wants to cut from vital supports that are helping people get to medical appointments or to keep their job, for example.
Sam, you appeared on the last day of Senate hearings about the bill. You were supportive of its intent, supportive of lots of the things in it, and you're asked towards the end whether, given this arbitrary power that the minister has, you supported the passage of the bill in its current form, if the choice was in its current form or not, and you replied, "No, Senator, I do not." Are these things, this power given to the minister, a deal breaker, in your view?
Well, sadly they are, because you're right. I think I'm really supportive of the intent of government to moderate the growth in the scheme and to make sure that it's around for future generations. And I think the intention of that growth target of 5 to 6% is fair and reasonable to do that. And as you said, a lot of the things in the bill, and we've talked about some of them, they really will, I think, help to make the scheme better for those that will continue to rely on it. But the kind of cut we've been talking about is the sort of thing that would be, I think, unthinkable if you tried to apply it to, say, hospital funding or Medicare, for example. So why is it acceptable in the context of the NDIS?
Pelin, a final question, perhaps. How do you see things playing out? Do you think the NDIS can get back on track, remaining huge, remaining bigger than Medicare, but by the end of the decade, no longer increasing as fast as it is?
I think it can, but I don't want to think sustainable to just in terms of hitting a certain spending number. In the long run, I think what will be important is making this market work better. The main reason for that is NDIS is a very persistent scheme, which means that once participants get into the NDIS, they stay long years. And we looked at this in the admin data, and what we find is when participants exit NDIS, they exit not because of they recover, they exit because of passing away. So that in the long run, participant numbers will grow, and only way to make the NDIS sustainable is getting value for money.
Sam, are you confident? And you've proposed regular reviews of these changes to, I suppose, monitor progress. Are they essential in your view?
I think they are. Look, I'm naturally optimistic. Whether the scheme gets back on track, in my view, is going to depend on staying the course on the necessary reform measures that we've got. The review point, I think, is really important. There are so many measures in this bill that are interdependent. There's so many things that need to be well sequenced. The legislated requirement for an independent review and evaluation, which I believe government has accepted, will be an important mechanism to mitigate risks of unintended consequences and negative consequences of some of the measures here, so that we can ensure there's the appropriate parliamentary scrutiny for a change of this size and importance.
Would it be true to say, and you were working on the National Health Scheme in the United Kingdom as the NDIS was unfolding in Australia, would it be true to say that the world is watching?
I think it would. Look, this still has the potential to be a world-leading scheme. I moved to Australia in 2018 to work on this scheme because it was very clearly the biggest social reform happening anywhere in the world at the time. It's hugely ambitious. I don't want this to end up being a case study of why politicians and governments shouldn't grapple with really hard challenges and problems in ways that are ambitious. Actually, we can set this thing right. It can be world leading, but I think there are a lot of people watching, as I'm continuously finding as I talk to people back home in the UK.
Sam Pellin, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Pellin.
I will use this opportunity to self-promote some of our research. So we have multiple projects on NDIS that we are using admin data to get out in coming month. So I'm looking forward to sharing them with everyone.
Sam.
Look, are we watching for the commencement of what will need to be a truly mammoth implementation effort across government to get these reforms right? And that's going to need to commence very quickly. We have a clock ticking. We have lots of complex problems to be solved, lots of design work and implementation to be started. So I'll be looking out to see how government is getting on with that.
Thank you, Sam Bennett, Disability Program Director at the Grattan Institute, and Pellin Akyol, Disability Researcher and Research Manager at the E61 Institute, for a most eye-opening look at what's now one of Australia's biggest schemes. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. The app, by the way, includes show notes and references, so you can read the report Sam and Pellin have written and the documents they've referred to. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Penny and Roger have done that. Roger says, I really enjoy the program. I learn a lot from it. I did economics for a whole 2 weeks as a 13-year-old in 1964. Didn't understand anything and changed to French. However, we've run our own business for 50 years, so we must have picked up something. And the music? Terrific. Who is it? Well, it's an internal ABC composition, Roger. The brief was for a jazzy vibe. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.